are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on today's show is someone I greatly admire and have known for nearly two decades, Dr. Titi Lola Banjoko. Nearly 20 years ago, she founded Find a Job in Africa, an Africa recruit in response to the needs of the African diaspora in the West. Dr. Banjoko currently serves on the Council of the Royal African Society, is a trustee of Tropical Health and Education Trust, chair of the Foundation for Women's Health Research and Development. She has previously served on the board of the European Commission, United Nations Joint Migration and Development Initiative, Department for International Development, Global Poverty Action Fund Advisory Board, amongst others. In her day job, she is an executive managing director in the NHS. Welcome to the Elephant in the Room podcast, Titi. I'm delighted to have you a guest on the podcast today, and congratulations on your recent appointment as chair.
Thank you very much, Suda.
Tell us a bit more about your journey, your childhood, education.
I would say my journey has been a very interesting one, one that has spanned Nigeria, the UK, and travels across the continent of Africa, and even indeed into the Caribbean. And let me explain. I was born in the United Kingdom of Nigerian heritage in the days when, under the British colony, it was always a thing that many of them came here to study. And then in those days, they used to go back immediately after they graduated. So I was taken back to Nigeria and spent a lot of my educational years in Nigeria. I then came back to the United Kingdom as a university graduate. I studied dentistry. But what had happened is, while I was growing up in Nigeria, I had seen poverty. Not for myself personally, but I was touched and moved by the impact poverty had on people's livelihood. And I had started developing a conscious awareness that I wanted to respond to people's needs and act where I could. That was evident in a number of things I had done, like fundraising for the motherless babies home, doing a lot of initiatives off my own back. So I became consciously aware that I had a responsibility because of the privilege I had to be able to respond to people's needs. Came to the UK, do what every migrant does, where you try and find how you're going to adjust within the community. You try and position yourself, get a job, do all the things that we need to do, and begin to become consciously aware that there is a difference here than when I was living in Nigeria, especially when you're in the minority. I then started developing a sense of awareness, as I said, that when it came to Africa, people always had to fly back to a country for a job interview. There was no one place where jobs were available. There was no one platform providing opportunities. And everything in life I've realized is about opportunities. It's by presenting opportunities that people are able to harness themselves. So I developed Find a Job in Africa and Africa Recruit, which I can talk to you about later. You become more exposed of the wide implications of policy, even outside your country, that have implications on the development of your country. The interconnectivity, it's amazing. And also the ability to support people through development policies. And since then, it's been a journey of discovery for me, a journey of discovery that everybody has the ability at different levels to make an impact. You can make it as individuals, organization, or even government level.
As usual, Titi, you're so inspiring. I just love to keep hearing you. So I met you approximately 18 years ago, as you said, at the Commonwealth Business Council when I was working there on the Commonwealth Business Women's Network. And you were in the process of incubating and launching Find a Job in Africa and Africa Recruit. And clearly, as you mentioned, you did that in response to the diaspora's need to look for opportunities without having to go back into the continent to look for it. You were already working long hours at the NHS I remember that you used to do shifts and then you used to be back in the office and then you used to be working and you used to do early morning, you used to do late night, and TT was always around working. What prompted you to do that? How did you find that drive? How did you find that energy?
I think the first thing is, if you believe in something, that's the first thing. I would say to you that your passion, I'm sure people have heard the saying, I don't get paid to do my job. I love what I do. And for me, Africa Recruit and find a job in Africa was a passion. And therefore, I actually didn't see it as a labor intensive. I actually saw it as my passion. And that was what drove me. What also drove me was seeing the results, giving birth to Africa Recruit and find a job and seeing it grow and develop was really overwhelming. And when I say develop, actually hearing people say, I got a job through find a job in Africa. I am now back here, or I'm now working in this country, and it was through find a job. When you see those outcomes, it just motivates you. And then for Africa Recruit, it was really about capacity building across the various continents. And when we started, human resources become something that people started promoting. The brain drain at that time seemed to be reversing because people were actually going back. Policies were being put in place to encourage diaspora return, diaspora investment, diaspora engagement. So all that gave me the confidence and the energy to keep going. As you said, I worked in the NHS. And the reason why I work in the NHS is I also believe in healthcare. And I do believe that that was also a growing platform. I always still believe that I'm on a journey of development and growth. And therefore, the twin tracks I described always run parallel, but it keeps the train going. And you have to define what is your own twin track and what's your real track and what enables your growth.
I love the twin track, TT. And I remember when Find a Job in Africa and Africa Recruit, when you launched it and the kind of engagement that it had from policymakers and governments across the continent and the UK and Europe, you know, the ILO, the African Union. So that was really amazing. And I think it was inspiring for us who were around you to see the incredible work that you did. You've spoken about the twin track and your own journey. And how has it been so far? That track also includes various intersectionalities, right? As a skilled professional, as an entrepreneur, as a woman of color, how has that been for you?
I think you really hit it on the head when you use the word intersectionality. It has brought together my experience on healthcare, because I'm an executive managing director now in the NHS, and understanding of how to develop healthcare systems as opposed to just delivering healthcare. As a woman, I am fully consciously aware of myself and my own imposter syndrome. And what I would define is, and you will recall this, Suda, as women, we sometimes don't feel we're confident enough to occupy a space. And so we're apologetic. I am consciously aware of that. I'm also consciously aware that being a Black person in the UK, operating sometimes in spaces where I'm the only person of color, how it can be challenging. But I have learned to grow with my confidence, learned to understand that I have the right to be where I am. And all this intersectionality keeps on reinforcing itself in my day job in the NHS. As an example, recently over the COVID period, it was reinforced that yes, I'm in position of leadership, but that brings with it responsibility and responsibility for me to act. Now, it's my years of engagement through Africa Recruit and Find a Job in Africa with governments, with high-level stakeholders and roundtables, as you described, at various parts within the continent, Africa, Europe. And indeed, there were times I actually did travel to the Caribbean on behalf of the Commonwealth. That made me understand that it's that same principle that I do need to engage and speak out. And how we do it is the key thing. In a way that actually engenders engagement with stakeholders, you can only facilitate change through engagement with the people who have the ability to bring about the change.
Yeah, that's so true. And I've been hearing so much about the imposter syndrome because everyone's now openly talking about it. You know, people feel that acutely during COVID-19 when they tried to sort of overreach or, you know, have an ambitious goal and they think, oh, maybe I'm not as good. And with the issues around inequity in the workplace, I think it has played out a lot. At the NHS, we've read reports about BAME communities being disproportionately impacted. And this is also to do with frontline health workers and to do with communities, because a lot of the health workers are from BAME communities. What do you think? Is there inherent inequity within the system?
Now, COVID-19 has only shone a torchlight on things that were there before. And when I say things, we've always had structural, systemic, and individual racial inequality in the United Kingdom. So COVID shone a torchlight. I'll give an example. An example is the BAME community actually conduct a lot of frontline jobs. If you go in the NHS, social worker, the service industry, supermarkets, everywhere you go, it's dominated by people from this community. The cleaners, the bus drivers, the nurses, the doctors, the social care workers that go into people's home or work in care home, the people who are security guards at the supermarkets. Now, while everybody was in lockdown, feeling safe in their big homes or away from the city, these communities kept the United Kingdom going. They paid the ultimate sacrifice. That meant they were more exposed compared to others. That's one thing. But the decisions that were being made in response to COVID were being made by people, may I say, who are not from these communities, or people who have no insight into these communities, the way we live, the way we interact, the jobs we do. So as a result of that, there was a greater exposure by these communities, because there was no regard for them. And that has been the unfortunate thing, because they are the ones who didn't feel they could talk. We've all gone through years of what we describe day-to-day microaggressions, where you get so used to it, so you just keep quiet and you do your bit. And sometimes that means people put themselves at risk, because if I talk, they might not hear, or they won't act, or I might even lose my job. So many of the BAME communities, if they felt it wasn't safe or they didn't have the personal protective equipment, they wouldn't say anything. They'll still go ahead and do the job. Many of them were agency workers. They're in low-paid jobs. Therefore, they were going home back to their communities after work and exposing their communities to some of these things. Whereas a lot of decision makers, may I say, live in rural areas, live in big mansions, are totally unaware of these things. And when you don't have a lived experience like that, actually, I don't think you can be making decisions. So these are the structural inequalities that have been there before COVID that all just came to light in the context of COVID.
Post-COVID-19, organizations are looking to embed purpose. Everyone is talking about purpose. Is there a connection between purpose, fairness, and equity? And is it just a buzzword? You know, whether it's the government or whether it's organizations, whether it's individuals, they're all talking about it. What is your take on that?
My take is that in some quarters, it's really genuine. They want to respond. They want to respond in a purposeful way to the inequities and probably are looking for us to support them. But this is going to require humility where there is a genuine intention. I do believe it requires a level of humility and discomfort that people haven't been used to. And when I mean discomfort, I'm not just talking about people who are not BAME, i.e. the white community. I'm also meaning within the BAME community, we also have to speak out. We have to articulate our experience. I don't want to make people feel uncomfortable, so we don't say things. We're apologetic. I said on Friday to someone, I don't know what it is to be white. I will never know what it is to be white. I can't, because I am not white. But I know what it is to be black. And I know what it is to live. So we all need to hear each other's story, be comfortable with being uncomfortable, agree that we need each other, and work collectively. You can't prescribe solutions for experiences you don't have. And that's the challenge. So I say to people, it is not about a tick box exercise of, oh, we're going to have a lot more ethnic people. It is diversity and inclusion. I'll give an example. The most diverse institution in the UK is actually the NHS.
Yeah, it is.
But it is not inclusive. It is diverse, but not inclusive. And the reason why you know it's not inclusive, as you go up the ladder, it gets whiter and whiter and whiter. And there was a book written by Roger Klein called The Snowy White Peaks. That was a number of years ago. It is still snowy white peaks.
This is what I was going to ask you, is that when we started working at the Commonwealth Business Council, a lot of it was about equity and inclusion and diversity. And, you know, almost 20 years later, we are still talking about it. There has not been, like you said, you know, no systemic change, and the inequalities are inherent in the system. Why is that? So we all have a lot of conversations. Again, we are having a lot of conversations. Why is no change happening?
I think there are two reasons why. One is there's been prescription of what the issue is by people who don't have the lived experience, coming up with solutions, and then implementing the wrong solutions because you don't know what the issue is. That's one part. The second part is those of us who are on the other side have been quiet. We speak to ourselves. We don't speak out. We speak to ourselves because we don't want people to be uncomfortable, because it is very uncomfortable. So we speak to ourselves. And it is only under the pandemic, because it became a life and death situation, that we started speaking out. And I believe, as I said earlier, that speaking out is saying, actually, no, this policy can't work. I'll give you an example. I asked the question recently, where did the number six come up? You know, the number six in terms of the government saying that the bubble is a six.
Yeah.
I asked somebody, I said, out of interest, where did that six come up? I'm not saying I agree or disagree with it. I said, in the BAME community, that's not the number. I said, so I'm not sure how they're repeating the same mistake. A bubble of sick in some BAME community is still one family. It hasn't included the mom that's living with them or the dad that's living with them, with the four children or five children they've got, with the cousin that lives with them, because that's how we live, we're communal.
Yeah.
I said, so I'm not clear which part of this six is coming from. I said, this is the thing that people still fail to understand. We live in multicultural, multi-diverse Britain, and therefore coming up with six is not the answer. And we now have to be speaking out to say, hang on, there are people who in their household, they're even eight. So if you say six, can you define that? For those who have household of 10, that might mean 12. And this is the issue, because even in the time of the height of COVID, and you know, there were times that social care workers who are working in care homes or nurses will leave work and go home. And the risk is they took things back home. They took some of these things and their families, because they don't live in big houses. They probably just live in a flat and expose people. So these are the things that we've got to speak out ourselves as we now occupy this space, and not be apologetic about it in a respectful manner, so that people begin to understand and have insight into areas where they don't have insight.
You know, when you say that we need to speak out, most of the time what migrant communities do is that they try to blend in. I was reading an interview today by Nadia, you know, the Great British Bake Off winner. And she said, I'm never going to be able to blend in because I'm not white. I'm not a man. I am a woman and I'm brown and I'm different. And so I'm not going to blend in. So you have to create those spaces for yourself and be able to speak to people respectfully. But we also have heard of the fatigue that people, you know, from the Black community have because of the microaggressions and years of keeping quiet and now being told to show what others need to do in order to be equitable and fair. What is your view?
Yes. So just to build on what you said, what I meant is, you're one thing at home, and you're another thing at work. So you are never yourself at work, because truly, when we understand that if we are self, it's not going to be accepted. So what Nadia, when she says don't blend in, we blend in at work because we pretend. We have two camouflage. What we take is a camouflage of how would I fit in? How would I not make myself career limiting? And therefore, people don't have insight into what it truly is like, because you are not able to really be yourself. I mean, the other day I was doing an interview for Black History Month with my co-lead on the BAME program. I said, there's a saying I tend to hear a lot. Oh, I don't see color. And I'm thinking, what do you mean you don't see color? I'm black. It's a bit obvious. I mean, if I'm in front of you, you can't say you can't see my color.
Yeah.
You do see color. And I think there's something about people being honest with themselves and trying to learn and trying to understand that you are uncomfortable with the conversation I'm having with you. And therefore, you come up with that statement, you don't see color. Or is it that you are actually so ignorant, which you have to be humble about, that you are totally unaware of how it is? And say it, because I don't expect you to be aware. I don't expect you to be aware of what it is to be stopped by police. I don't expect you to be aware of what it is like for people to be racist towards you. I don't expect you, because how can you? You are not me. But if you let me educate you, if you have an open attitude and walk alongside me and empathize, then there is. And I always look back to one of my heroes, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I always say, when he was marching, there were a lot of white people that marched with him. And they did it at their sacrifice of themselves. Does it mean they were going through the same experience as Dr. Martin Luther King? No. But what it meant is they had empathy and they understood and they played their role. And that's what we want. And that's what we need. It's walking alongside. It's not walking behind you. It is walking alongside you.
Yeah, working alongside to have the same opportunities and the same sort of life that people should have. It shouldn't be different for different people. It should take into consideration, you know, what my requirements are. As you said, we don't bring our whole self to work because we are worried whether it'll be career limiting or people will say. I think 18 years ago, I remember when we used to have food from different communities, there used to be a bit of a fuss in the office. I think we've moved from there.
But I think we need to move beyond the food now to actually understanding who's behind the food.
Yeah.
What is behind the food? And I think it goes back to a common phrase that people use now, which is called white fragility or white privilege. Are you one that is fragile, therefore I can't speak the truth to you? Or are you one that acknowledges your white privilege and therefore wants to be of value to me? This is the thing that people have to understand. When a white person goes to many parts of the world because of the colonial history, they are still treated with privilege. And these are things that, therefore, they have to acknowledge that years of colonial rule, years of slavery have resulted in some of these legacies that we're still unwrapping today. But one thing I can say is the next generation are not standing for what we stood for.
They are impatient. They want equity. They want equality. And they're going to get it. They're not going to just try to blend in or just try to behave as if nothing has happened. You know, when I used to travel to Africa, it used to be so difficult for me on my Indian passport. Everywhere you get stopped and you need to stand back because they do multiple checks. Sometimes they'll make you wait beyond. So, yeah, I understand why people want a British passport now.
But you see the difference. And that's why I'm saying the privilege, because the one with the British passport has a different experience. But that experience is born out of legacies from the colonial days. It is privilege. And when you have a privilege, then do you not also have an ethical and moral duty to help the less privileged?
Absolutely. And to be allies to people, walk with them, and understand the journey and also do a bit of the work. I think there's so much information out there now. It's been out there for some time, but in the past year, even more, there is a proliferation of information which people can just read. And how difficult is it for people to understand how to be fair and how to be equitable? That's a sort of a difficult conversation. So with Black Lives Matter, you believe definitely that the needle has moved and things will change.
I do believe that it has changed and will change and continue to change. Because like I said earlier, maybe our generation and our parents' generation, because they just came out of the colonial rule, the next generation have no idea, don't even recognize the history. They know their rights. They know what they're entitled to, and they're not going to accept. They are not going to accept what our parents accepted. Can you imagine what happened to our parents? Many of our parents went through severe, severe discrimination. Then we had a little bit of it, not as acute as they did, because in their days it was throwing things at their faces and doing all sorts of things. And we had a bit of it. The next generation are totally removed from all these things. So they believe that they're equally entitled. And because of multicultural Britain, as an example, I always say sometimes somebody is speaking, you know, you could almost close your eyes and think it was a white person, but it's an Asian.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard a black Scottish person.
Yes.
Where they speak with real Scottish accent. Where do you think they're going? They're Scottish and they have every right as the white Scot person. And they're not going to back down the way we back down. They were born, they were bred, they lived here, they grew up here, they don't know any other place, and they're staying here. And they will push for their rights.
That's so true, Titi. You've recently been appointed as the chair of the International Rescue Committee. Congratulations on that, first of all. And what is your biggest task at hand?
I must say it's an absolute privilege for me to be appointed the chair of the International Rescue Committee, United Kingdom. I don't know if people know about the organization, but it's an organization that was set up really to respond to the severe needs and crisis faced by refugees, migrants, asylum seekers globally. And unfortunately, this is a growing industry. Not because in as much as we all would want it to be an area where there's a reduction, there are lots of people who have actually grown up in refugee camps. There are more internally displaced or externally displaced people than has ever been recorded for either political, social, or economic reasons. Every human being wants the ability to thrive. But people are even fleeing countries because they can't even survive and making desperate attempts to. So being the chair, one of my absolute privilege will be to actually begin to highlight refugees and migrants who were accepted into many countries years ago and are now productive contributing members of that society. Because the narrative at the moment is a negative narrative when people hear of refugees, migrants, and asylum seekers. And I think we like to share our successes as countries, but we have challenges sharing what is not good. And these are things that we need to understand the root causes of why people have to migrate, and then address that with countries. And where it's not possible, try and minimize it and then give people safe passage. There's nothing that anybody wants but the dignity of human beings. I ask myself the question, because of COVID, Syria has disappeared from the news. Is there not a war in Syria? Yemen has disappeared from the news. There are people fleeing Myanmar. Then there are economic challenges. So I think we all, as human beings, have to acknowledge that where we were born is a matter of luck. The countries where we happen to have been born, the countries that are going through crisis, how do we support people so that they at least have some form of dignity?
That's such a big task Titi. But from there, I'll come back to a bit about what we were talking about, Black Lives Matter and history, and how history perhaps has played a role in not creating as much awareness about the contribution of people from across the Commonwealth, but also talking about the not so good things that happened under the colonial rule. What is your opinion?
I totally agree. I totally agree with that, because if you don't understand history or don't know history, you might not understand where people are coming from. So telling the history will make people understand why some parts of the issues that we're still facing today.
Because people continue to feel the consequences of it today.
Exactly. The other day I was, you know, really reflecting when all the issues of statues was brought up. We can't get rid of some of these statues, I'm going to be honest. Because I looked and I thought, otherwise we're going to have to get rid of the whole of the United Kingdom. Because a lot of things were born on slave trade. So let's accept it, but let's speak it out. And where there is a need, there should be some form of structural adjustment programs put in place. That is why after apartheid in South Africa, there was all this black affirmative action. You have to affirm, is it equity or equality? You have to create platforms for equality. It's like in the US, how the white people were given land and the blacks went. And yet that becomes a generational thing. As you know, if anybody has land, you are able to put someone in a race ahead of someone else because of that. To think that only recently were the families or the descendants of slave trade paid their full compensation for the slaves that they had to free. But yet this didn't happen to the slaves who actually should have been compensated. So that is why the history needs to be told.
Titi, you are so driven. Have you achieved some of the things that you set for yourself?
I would say I'm on a journey and I've ticked up some things, but I still have so more to tick off. So setting up Find a Job in Africa and Africa Recruit, I find that as an absolute pleasure that people have those opportunities. And then to see some of the developments where people have gone back to the continent and are now contributed positively, that's an achievement. Am I happy? No. Because I sometimes feel that it's one step forward, two step backwards by way of the impact of what is happening. And there's always more to be done. As long as there are people who have a need, there's always more to be done. And so my drive will not stop. I also, one part I'm loving is working with the younger generation. The younger generation are so driven, and it reminds me of myself. And I therefore want to work with them, especially with their new innovative ideas and creative ideas of how they're transforming, of how they're challenging, you know, norms. So I wouldn't say I've achieved. We can't say we have achieved. We've tried and we'll continue to try, but there's still a lot more to do.
You're going to be striving to do a lot more, and I'm sure there's lots of wonderful things to that you're going to do. To conclude, what are the three things you would say that people should do to have a more equal society?
Three things. So I've got to make sure that I pick
you
my
can say five also.
I think the first thing is recognition that there isn't an equal society. Because if you don't recognize and you don't admit that there is, because some people think it is unequal because people haven't taken opportunities given them. So the first thing is that. The second thing is actually creating that environment that enables equality, but recognizing that some people need more help than others and putting structures and systems in place to enable that. The third thing for me is humility. And humility means being ready to work with people who are not like you, people who actually probably don't say the same things you say.
That's so true, Titi. And this has been such an incredible conversation, incredible, motivating and inspiring. Thank you so much for making the time for this. I really enjoyed the conversation.
you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.